Blog Talk Radio.
We're a nation of haters under their control. Rise up everybody and burn down the system. Pay us the exit rules. Wake up the silence.
Everybody, and this is Steven Zimmer, and welcome to the Star Chamber Show, episode number 8. And we are really excited about tonight's show. We have Gnostic wisdom coming your way in the form of the great Michael Nost, an author extraordinaire. And we are going to get to a whole hour of Michael coming up here just a bit. But first of all, I'd like to definitely invite people, check out last week's episode with Andy Hott of Zero King, the guys that gave us our lead-in music with Showtime that you just heard a clip from. Andy actually is going to be joining us again on the 29th because we actually got so enthralled with his band stuff, we actually failed to talk to him a lot about book stuff. So we definitely want to have that as part of our segments with these music guests. So Andy's going to be joining us again on the 29th. And, of course, you know, joining him on the show last week was the great Charles Day, Evil Jester Press and Evil Jester Comics. And so that was a fantastic show and definitely worth seeing. And you can check out any of our shows. They're all archived. You can stream them, download them, all of them linked. You can get links to all of them off of our main page over on Blog Talk Radio. And be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter as well. And on that 29th show that Andy's going to be coming back to, we also have J.L. Mulvihill, author of The Boxcar Baby, and she's going to be joining us in the Star Chamber. And then next week, I'll give one little promo tag here. We have a very special guest, Rachel Smith of Bitten by Books, a fantastic, fantastic book site that gets really, really heavy traffic. And also we have the wonderful Violet Patterson, author of the Emerald Seer series, Paranormal Urban Fantasy. So we have a great show coming up for you next week. But one thing I wanted to announce tonight, we have some breaking news that just came together just prior to the show, as a matter of fact. This is for Imaginarium 2014. As you know, it's a creative writing convention, so it's focused not just on book writing, but on all forms of creative writing. And one of the things we're really proud to have is a screenwriting track and an associated film festival with it. And as of tonight, we are proud to announce that our second Imaginator, and these are like our very highlighted, spotlighted special guests, but our next Imaginator is a screenwriter and a Hollywood screenwriter at that. We are proud to announce that the man behind the Final Destination movies, Jeffrey Reddick, a screenwriter, will be joining us at Imaginarium 2014 as one of our Imaginator guests. And, of course, Jeffrey, in addition to his work with the Final Destination franchise, has also done a number of other great films, including the remake of Day of the Dead, Return to Cabin by the Lake with USA Networks, and he's also in the works currently with The Undertakers, which is based off the young adult series, and Superstition for Global Renaissance Entertainment. So Jeffrey's got some great new projects in the works, and of course everybody knows him from the Final Destination movies, but he will be joining us at Imaginarium next September 19th to 21st, and so you can get a chance to meet him and hear from him and interact with him on the track, and we are really, really excited about that. And what do you all think, guys?
Oh yeah.
Oh my god.
I'm like just completely speechless on everything, but at the same time,
I have all my DVDs ready for signatures, and I can't wait for September. It's like just too far away right now.
Yeah, I know that's right up Michael's alley movie-wise, too, because, you know, and I should mention that it's one of the few, Jeffrey's one of the few screenwriters who created an enduring horror franchise, because,
yeah.
I mean, this, the you know, Finalist Nation,
the first
big
film,
success.
Like, it was just like a thunderbolt. Like, it was so different, and so, it was just like a punch in the face. It was fabulous, and I just wanted to keep watching it and figure out all the little details and how everything played into each other. Love that movie so much.
I'm truly a sick puppy because when Final Destination came out, I told my grandma that it was a romantic comedy, so we watched it together. she actually asked her it was over. She said, oh, that was cute. And then when the second one came out, she said, might as well. Survived the first one.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I like to play it off. I tried to convince her that Human Centipede was a romantic comedy as well, but she didn't buy that one.
Alex.
What? I'm sick.
I can't hear. No, you're off. This is how we get along, but oh my God.
But yes, the Final Destination movies, they're absolutely brilliant. It's almost like how you would see a Warner Brothers cartoon or something like that. This little fragment leads to this and this and this, and then it adds to the bigger picture.
Well, even like the deaths and stuff, like you're right in like the cartoon comparison, because I mean, you can see it coming to a point, but it just traps you. Like, you cannot look away from some of that imagery and just how every little thing plays into each other. I just remember being absolutely gobsmacked just like sitting there, because I saw it, I think I had the VHS or DVD or something when I was still in college. But I just sat there in my apartment just like jaw on the floor watching this thing, and just like, I wish I had been smart enough to think of that. Like, it was such a great idea.
Right. And for it to continue into a franchise, I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. And the thing is, it's to the point where all of my friends and myself were like, oh my God, if they do another one, it could be based around this tragedy. It's weird that we're so hyped up tragedy.
There was like I don't remember. It was like somewhere in Europe where like they didn't get on the flight, and the flight ended up like killing everyone on board. So they were like really relieved, and then they were driving home and then had a car wreck and were both killed.
Yeah, it's all the movies play on a dark humor, because even with the first one, the kill scenes after the tragic plane crash, the kill scenes are shocking, but at the same time, it's so blunt and in your face, you have really no choice but to laugh at it. And it's kind of a defense mechanism to the point how do I react to this?
Right, the one with the teacher where the vodka goes into the computer and then it starts the fire, and then the knife. I sit there and I cackle at that just the whole time.
Oh, my God, I would have to say the scene in part two with the guy that was in the field and the barbed wire fence cut him in thirds. That was pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All I got to say is I stay clear of logging trucks now. I stay far away from them.
That's always been something that makes me nervous, going down the highway and one of those things pulls up next to you and you just – or anything really, those oversized loads with, like, you know, you've got the trucks that are carrying the big sewer pipes or whatever, and you know, they decide to pull up next to you. You can just see, like, those bungee cords giving way.
Yeah.
See, that doesn't bother me as bad as the roller coaster in part three. To start with, I am terrified of heights. I've never been on a roller coaster. I never want to go on a roller coaster. And after watching Final Destination 3, it just sealed the deal right there.
See, having worked around that sort of thing and, like, I mean, not on them or anything, but in that environment and, like, I know theoretically they're supposed to be safe, but yeah, like after seeing that, and just like that's how my mind works, like there's no way. Like, I mean, that would be my stupid luck. Would be the day I decide to just be like, okay, fine, we'll try it out. That would be the day that, like, everything goes wrong.
I actually know people who refuse to go to a tanning bed because of the scene in Part 3. They went to a tanning bed nonstop, and they saw Final Destination 3. They have not returned to one since.
Well, it gets in your head. Like, all these things, I mean, you know, theoretically, okay, not going to happen, but what if? I mean, that's the mark of good horror. It's that what if, okay, this may be cartoony on the screen, but what if, you know, what if that's, you're the, like, 0.001% chance that suddenly everything spazzes out and that happens too.
Yeah, it really taps into paranoia. It really truly does.
Well, I was, I went to Stratosphere at in Vegas. And they've got all those amusement park rides at the top of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was one that I said that I would not do, which was one where it basically you were sitting in kind of a swing chair, and there was an arm that took you and spun you out over the city, and there was, like, nothing under your feet for, you know, however many thousands of feet you could hit the. So I said, no, I'm not going to get on that. So, but one of the other rides I did get on, I thought it was going to be some kind of roller coaster. But what happened was, and of course, I was the only one on this car. So there, that should have keyed me in that no one wanted to ride this thing. But I get on this thing, and what it does is the track go. It's on like a big board, like a section of track, and it just goes up like it's going to go up into the sky. Well, when this thing starts, you go up to the end of that track, and the whole board, it's a teeter-totter, and it swings down so that you're looking straight down onto the streets of Vegas.
Oh, hell no.
No.
And
no.
I would have made sailors blush. I was screaming.
Yeah.
It's like Samuel L. Jackson would have gone, damn.
Yeah.
I was cussing up a storm. and then it tilts you back and you're like, oh, okay, it's over. But then it does it again. And
I just
kept thinking, you know, there are so many things that could possibly go wrong with that.
Yep. No, I'm just imagining that. And for some reason, and I could be wrong on this, but why am I imagining that when it kind of teeter-totters down, where you can see everything that's below you, that every time it comes back down, it goes further down? Why am I imagining that?
I think it did. I think you're right.
Oh,
I think
probably.
You did. I think you did.
Don't
I don't know.
Paranoia.
I tried to block it out of my mind. So
this is like when I talk to friends about, and they're all about all this stuff. And I'm just like, I have this human fear of like plummeting. There's no. Like you can have fun with that. I'm going to stay on the ground and plot world domination. You go do your thing. There's no way. No.
No, I'm very happy on the ground, thank you. I'm very happy behind the computer desk writing and editing. No flights for me, please.
So, Michael, does that mean that we're going to, in one of your books, you're going to have, like, this teeter-totter of death now?
I don't know. Just about anything that happens to me ends up in a book sooner or later, so it's possible.
No.
my wife always gets mad at me because she'll read the books and she never wants to read them until after they're out and on Kindle or Nook or whatever. And so she'll sit there and she'll read a book and then she'll come up and she'll just like hit me on the back of the hand. I'm like, what? And she goes, I can't believe you wrote about that.
Well,
that's the beauty about being in a relationship with an author, may it be a romantic relationship, family relationship, or friend relationship. Whatever aspects are being brought into that author's life are eventually going to end up on page.
Yeah. Even if you're not even trying to do it, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right.
It just bleeds out.
Yep.
Well, I have some good news for you all, fellow hosts. We have a successful connection with our guest tonight, and he is currently on cue here. And so I wanted to just dive in here and let you know and get this party started. Tonight's guest, of course, is the Bram Stoker Award-winning Michael Nost, editor, author. I mean, he's got loads of great anthologies. He's got novel project, Kickstarter project, all kinds of stuff he's going to talk to us tonight about. So without further ado, I wanted to welcome Michael Nost to the Star Chamber. You are live, sir, and glad to have you aboard.
Yay. Good to be live. Good to be live. How are you?
Doing good. We're doing good. Good to hear from you, and glad you could join us for the show tonight. I mean, because you have a busy, busy time going on, and I know that all of our hosts want to talk to you tonight about various things, but we definitely want to cover some of the absolute up-to-date latest stuff in the world of Michael Nost. And one involves, of course, your brand-new novel, Return of the Mothman, and then we also want to talk about your new Kickstarter project. So let's let's talk about your new book, because that's a brand spanking new project that's coming out about right now.
Yeah, it's going to be out any day now, and just waiting to get that, and there's pre-orders for it right now if anybody's interested. It's Return of the Mothman, and it's I'm from West Virginia, born and raised, and the Mothman has been something that's been creeping us out for many years in this neck of the woods, and it's been a long time since we've heard of the Mothman and or heard from the Mothman, and I thought, yeah, this is something I think that I would really like to sink my teeth into, and I did something quite different than what it was expected, and I think if you read the book, you'll know what I'm talking about. But it was a lot of fun, and a lot of fun because a lot of people from this area where I live, they're crazier than I am as far as Mothman goes. So, and it's saying something because I'm pretty crazy, as most of them know.
It was a nice little review that FearNet gave you on it.
Yeah, we have the. I've had a couple of FearNet and Hell Notes did a good one too, and I was really pleased. And let's see, and I'm waiting to hear back from some of the bigger ones with Publishers Weekly and stuff like that. So I'm scared to death.
Do you get a lot of inspiration from, because I love reading about like Mothman and different local folklores from different regions and things like that. Is that something that you're attracted by, not only for your writing, but just in general?
Yeah, I get anybody that, knows most of my work is pretty much steeped in Appalachia and I guess you could say, and Michael West. In case you guys, I don't know if you guys know him or not, but he's a pretty good writer himself, and he's in one of my Legends of the Mountain State books,
yeah.
Which we take legends of West Virginia, and we have the writers to delve in and create a new story, wrapped around them, and so, the Mothman is one of those, and yeah, those legends that have a little mythology to them, it really is very interesting to me, and never seem to run out of ideas, and with that kind of stuff, and it's a lot of fun.
Mr. Nost, this is Alex Brown, and I have a question for you.
Alex, time out. Hold on. Mr. Nost,
yeah.
Whoa.
Michael.
Hold on. Let me see if I can get my dad on the phone for you, okay?
Hey, by the way, before you're a horror author with humor, love it, love it.
Hey, before you ask your question, I just want to point out one thing. You know, we've been into this I guess 5 minutes, 10 minutes already, and no one has asked me the question if being a writer, a famous writer or editor, helps get me laid.
You have to save that for the end, you know, go out with a bang. God, that's going to be a good question.
I'm a little disappointed.
Word,
okay.
Go out with a bang, that's great.
Mr. Noss, I've heard you're a fabulous lover. Someone told us that when they gave us the list of questions we were supposed to ask. So, you know.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
My reputation is paid quite well, I guess, huh?
Your check is cleared.
Okay, Alex, I am so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, so go ahead.
Today has been one of those days, and you just, that was great. I needed that comic relief. Being a huge fan of urban legends and just mythology, folklore, the whole nine yards, since you wrote about a creature that is technically an urban legend, have you ever had any experience with this creature, or do you believe in the myth of that specific creature?
You know, there's never – I do book signings just about every weekend. And mm-hmm. I'm somewhere on the map doing book signings, and a lot of them, of course, here in West Virginia. And there's not one book signing that goes by that I don't have someone asking me that very question. And it's a good question. And I also get the same question about ghosts and so forth. But I can tell you this. I have never had an experience that I have ever seen anything supernatural other than my wife saying yes, that she would marry me, because it had to be supernatural that she would accept. But I've never seen anything. I've never seen a ghost. I've never seen anything of the Mothman. But I've heard so many stories from people that I know for a fact would never, you know, just try to fudge it or try to lie or try to come up with something. And I've sat and listened, chill bumps, you know, up my arm at the stories and some great things that I've learned. But I will tell you this, while I was writing The Mothman, and you probably get a kick out of this, but my home office is detached from my home. But it's about, I guess, I don't know, about 20 feet away from the house to walk, you know, in the backyard to get to the office. And I'll never forget, while I was writing The Mothman, it was always in the back of my mind, if he's real, does he know that I'm doing this? Does he approve? You know, and you know, what if I make him, you know, mad? And so I kind of was, you know, walking back and forth in the middle of the night looking for red eyes in the skies, you know, so, but I never saw them.
And you just touched on something that I've actually witnessed myself with people who have had experiences with the supernatural or urban legends. You can always tell the ones who have had a legit experience, because they come up to you and they have this sincerity about them, and also an extreme shyness that shows that they're a little embarrassed about their situation, but at the mm-hmm. same time, they want to relate it to someone who has written about it. That versus the people that come up, oh, my God, let me tell you what I've seen, and they try to boast about it as loud mm-hmm. as they can to draw attention. That's the times when I notice when a person is serious or just wanting attention, is if they actually
yeah.
do it modestly in their presentation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And one of the things that I see that almost every time that I'm on a book signing, and it's so funny because the one thing that they almost always say to me is, I've never told anyone this. You know, and here they're telling me, a perfect stranger, this, but I think they feel a connection or a kinship, and they feel safe because I write about it, you know, and they it's kind of fun to sit there and you know, have a really, really deep connection with someone that you don't know, and to hear them, you know, telling things that I've heard, you know, people saying, you know, I've never told my husband this, but, you know, blah, 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 or I've never told my wife this, and go into a story. And so it's, you know, in stories, this is the one thing that I say so often. Storytelling has gone back so many centuries, gone back so many, you know, for years and years and years and years. And the thing about storytelling is it's communication, and and it helps with bringing us together. And it's a good way to look at that when I'm sitting there in a book signing, and then a perfect stranger walks up to me, and they start telling their story. We're communicating. We're bonding over something, whereas they normally would have walked right by me and never said a thing. So that's the power of storytelling. It's the power of story, and we all have that in us, deep in us. And
that says something that kind of evolves, not like book signs where, you know, generations ago that would happen, like, around the kitchen fire, kitchen table, and back way generations that would happen around, you know, the village fire or whatever. That, you know,
especially.
I feel like the folklore and things like that, like, there's something really primal about legends and folklore and fairy tales and things like that, where it really sort of connects, like, it's almost like it's inherent in our genetics that to focus on stories like that, and we want to participate, and we want to hear about them, and you know, sort of give back and forth, like what you were talking about.
Yeah, I agree. It's something that's within all of us, and it's like I said, I think it's a communication type of thing that's inside us, and you know, genetics. That sounds really, you know, really good. The thing, you know, we have to look at is, you know, many of the ghosts, many of the legends that we have, were not made up here in America. They were brought here from many, many years ago, from, you know, Ireland and from Scotland and the UK and all different areas and everywhere. And it's so cool that we can bring them here and make them our own. And it kind of reminds me of Neil Gaiman's book, American Gods. Bring our gods here, you know, and we did that with our legends. We did it with our ghosts, and we brought our horrors with us, and that's what I think is so cool. And the horror is about sympathy. It's about empathy. And every time that you think about the stories that you hear or you read in that vein, it's about the human element. And no matter how scary the monster is, it's always about the human element. And that's something that every one of us can relate with. And that's why I think it's so important that the storytelling continues, even with people who don't even consider themselves storytellers. The guy that's walking by, you know, at the bookstore and wants to tell me, you know, what he saw, you know, 23 years ago while he was hunting, you know, by himself. So it's pretty cool.
Now, you had mentioned the human element. How do you feel about humanized monsters? And I'm not talking about this crap like Twilight and stuff like that. I'm actually talking about monsters that you could have an emotion for, such as some of the creatures that Clive Barker has written about or John Abbott Lindquist. How do you feel about when you give a dark creature human elements that someone can relate to?
Well, I think it brings another element of fear, and it also allows the reader to look at them. You see, the one thing you have to keep in mind is the reader is living vicariously through the main character, which is the human, most of the time. There are cases where you do have monsters as the protagonist. But the thing is when you have that human element there, and the reader is living vicariously through that, they can be horrified even more so from a monster that, you know, can reason, can talk, does have human aspects to it. The Mothman is one of those things. You know, the Mothman doesn't speak, but has the form of a man and you know, wings, and that's creepy. That's scary alone. He doesn't have to talk. He you know, has the form of a human. So, and I think, you know, as humans, you know, we feel sorry for, you know, there's times that you would feel sorry for the monster. You would, you know, oh my gosh, that must be horrible, or, you know, wow. And so it takes on a different form, I think. And, you know, every monster is different, and thank goodness for that. Need more new monsters too, by the way.
With Return of the Mothman, something that I had always pondered about with the urban legend and by reading the book and seeing the movie, the Mothman always kind of seemed like one of those gray characters to me. And what I mean by gray is it seems like it was a character that is a frightening character, but at the same time he's giving these prophecies to people where they can prevent disaster. Does your book, Return of the Mothman, kind of elaborate on that some, such as his personality?
My book actually exposes that to the quick. And the one thing that I don't want to give anything away, but that is a big, it's a big part of the book is that very thing. I can tell you this. Everyone thought that the Mothman was predicting danger to help humans avoid, and that's not the case. He can predict things, but it's all about the Mothman. It has nothing to do with helping humans.
Oh, wow.
If that helps you. Wow.
It does. Thank you. And let's see. I believe that we were interested in about the Kickstarter project as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's that's a new thing that, well, I've been working on for a while. I love Westerns. Westerns is a genre that I've gone back for many, many years reading. Every two or three years, I try to read True Grit, which, you know, I think is a beautiful book. And then Lonesome Dove, if you've never read the Lonesome Dove book, it's a masterpiece. And I love taking that element and then putting in horror, putting in science fiction, putting in fantasy, and bringing out something that's quite different. But still, it's very much set in the Old West. And Joe Lansdale, of course, is probably the best known when it comes to that. And so I'm real happy to get him on board with that. But yeah, the Kickstarter is just started, and I'm excited about where that's going to go. And we've got some really, really great names already signed up for it. Bentley Little and Joe Lansdale, Steve Rasnick, Tim, Jonathan Mayberry, Tom Piccirilli, and Gary Bronbeck, Elizabeth Baer, Laird Barron, Tim Wagner, Elizabeth Massey, Ronald Kelly, Lucy Snyder, Joe McKinney. And I'm also going to open up the doors for anybody to submit as well, if it's funded, of course. And so we're going to have some fun with it, I think.
Wow, that's awesome.
Now, when you talk about weird Westerns, this is something that's kind of intriguing me, because I know, like, when you think Western, you think about, like, the classic, you know, gunslinger or the things that typically happen within that realm. Is that what you're thinking about when you want to bring a horror or sci-fi element to Western, or do you think in broader terms, or what does the weird Western, I guess if you're going to call it that, mean to you specifically?
Well, I'll tell you what it means to this particular anthology, and we'll go from there. The Weird Western, what I'm looking for is stories set in the Old West, and it has to stay true to the Old West, in other words, and be a true Western. But you can throw in aliens, you can throw in zombies, you can whatever you want to do. It's wide open as long as think Cowboys and Aliens. That was a completely a Western movie, you know, but it had aliens in it and so forth. Wild Wild West. You can also look at steampunk.
Do you remember a movie, Michael, called Curse of the Undead from 1959? Well, not that you were around, but growing up, they used to show this late at night. But it was one of my favorite films as a child. But it was basically about a vampire gunslinger. In the end, they and Tarantino kind of took this for From Dusk Till Dawn too, which is the only other time I've ever seen it. But in the end, this priest, you know, at a gunfight on Main Street, defeated the vampire because he carved the cross on the end of his bullet.
Oh, I've not seen that.
That
would fit it. Yeah, that would fit it for sure. And Doctor Who had an episode where a town called Mercy, I think it was called, and that would fit as well. You know, it's set in Jonah Hex. You know, is another good example of that, which, you know, Joe Lansdale really carved his initials in Jonah Hex himself, you know, in the comic set. You know, he was a writer for a lot of that. And by the way, I want to mention, too, that Courtney Skinner is going to be doing the artwork for the cover of this, and I'm really excited about that because he is such a genius, such a great, great artist, and great guy too.
Well, I know you've won the Bram Stoker Award in your role as an editor. What are some of the challenges that you've experienced as an editor as opposed to a writer?
Well, as an editor, it's the one thing that you have on both ends is time. No matter what you're doing, you know, and deadlines are always looming. And one of the things that I got myself into a couple of times was taking on too many projects and then trying to juggle them. So I'm kind of scaling back now, and I'm not doing as many things. And I guess one of the bigger challenges with writing is, as an editor, you can rely on great work from great writers, and you can produce great works by great writers. But when it's coming down to yourself as a writer, it's all on you. So you have to be able to produce great work yourself. Which, I hope that I've done. But that's probably one of the bigger challenges, I think. And Mike, you've served as an editor with the Vampires Don't Sparkle, right?
Right.
So I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was I know that I had a similar experience in that, especially with the vampire anthology was appropriately enough invitation only. So then I was able to, count on the talents of a lot of, as you said, excellent writers where, I didn't feel the full burden on my shoulders where, like you said, whenever you produce your own fiction, it's all you.
Yeah. And it's always easier to, I think it's always easier to see what's wrong with a story when it's someone else's story.
I know that's where I was just going to say that that's one of the things that that I've noticed too, and you know, receiving different stories and whatnot, and reading other stories, is that, you know, I can read a story and know within a paragraph or two that, oh, I've got to have this story, or you know, this story is perfect for what I'm looking for. Have you ever had that kind of aha eureka moment where you know with, you know, that this is exactly the theme I'm going for in this anthology, the tone I'm going for?
Oh yeah, you know, when I did the Specters and Coal Dust, as soon as I announced it, I had Christopher Golden contact me, and he said, I have a story already, would you be interested in it? And I'm like, yeah, you know. And so he sent it to me, and I read the story, and it was the epitome of what the anthology was supposed to be, and it was exactly what the anthology was supposed to be. And I, you know, there's no more joy in a you know, an anthologist or an editor's life than, you know, to find that story to come across like that. And I've been very fortunate to have some extremely great writers to contribute and do just that. You know, when you work with Gary Bronbeck and Elizabeth Massey and many of those, you know, Steve Rasnick, Tim, you don't even have to read the story, pretty much. You already know that it's going to be one that's knocked out of the ballpark. I found that, you know, on the other hand, too, as a writer, you know, it's harder to catch things, you know, than it is as being the editor. And the editor, to me, you know, I'm very anal about everything. I mean, anal. I mean, trust me when I say this, Stephen can tell you, working with me with Writer's Workshop of Science Fiction and Fantasy, which, you know, he and Seven Star did, I probably drove him crazy, you know, with so many little tiny things, but it's so important, and to get the small things as well as the big things. But it's so hard to catch those little tiny things whenever you're doing it, you know, when you're the writer. I'll never forget. I was writing a weird Western story myself. It's been a while back, and it's been published two or three times. And it was set where in the Old West, and let's see. I forget now exactly what all was going on with it, but I had I was talking about the main character. He and his wife moved to where it was because they were escaping, trying to get away from his harsh father and her parents' Mormon traditions. And I have a good friend who was an editor for Writer's Digest, Jeff Fuller, who is a fantastic editor, fantastic writer. And he looks at everything that I do, and Jeff read the story, and he said, "What do you mean Mormon traditions? It was just getting started." And I was like, "Holy crap! I would have caught that if, you know, someone else would have written that, but no, it was me, so I couldn't even see it."
And I want to back you on that, because with me editing anthologies, I'm very new to that. And as a matter of fact, the new Southern Haunts book that's coming out is the second anthology I've worked on. It is true what you've said. Finding mistakes in other people's writing is very easy, but when it comes down to your own, you almost end up missing that. And what I've literally had to do was try to detach myself from my own piece of work and look at it as if it was someone else's piece. And it's weird how a person's brain can work that way.
Yeah, one of the things that I have found for me personally, if it's a short story especially, is to write the story and get it exactly the way I want it and put it up and start working on another story, and then finish that story, and then do another story, two stories. Pretty much once I've gone through two stories, when I go back to that first story, I'm kind of seeing it with fresh eyes and eyes of an editor, you know, in that it's not really my story, it's someone else's. And
exactly.
That always helps. But it takes patience to do that, and it's a hard thing to do, and it's probably one of the worst enemies of a newbie writer is not having patience. They want to write it, and before they even work in editing on it at all, they want to send it out, you know, and not that there's anything wrong, I'm just saying that's, but it would really help them and their self-esteem and their writing if they would, you know, take more time and just let it, you know, you take it off the front burner and put it on the back burner and let it cool for a while and start, you know, cooking the steak.
Yeah, and a lot of times that's just something that an author has to learn on their own. You can have 100 people tell you that, but until you actually sit there and understand it for yourself and see it for yourself, it can be a long road before you actually reach that wall of realization.
And even like go through it a few times to get it in your head, because I mean, you don't. Of course, you don't want to believe that applies to you the first time it happens.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. Yeah. I would never fall for that, you know. And I'll tell you another thing, too, is in my novel I had a character that shows up later in the novel and is a really good character. And whenever I gave the book, the manuscript to Jeff, he went through it and read it, and he said, you know, you really ought to introduce that character earlier in the novel. And I got to thinking about it. I was like, oh, my God, I know better than that. You know, it's little tiny things, you know, that so it's always good to have someone else who is really good to go back and, you know, and have somebody that's not afraid to, you know, kick you in the rear and tell you to, hey, you got to do this, you got to do that. You don't want someone reading your story that is going to be kissing your rear. You want them kicking your rear.
Right. What I like to do is I also like to find people who don't even read horror, you know, people who may not even like horror, because what I've found in the past is that people who are fans of the genre tend to ignore or wash over the cliches and conventions of the genre, whereas somebody who's not a fan of the genre will take you to task and say, you know, why the hell would they do that, you know?
Yeah.
And you're like, well, yeah, okay. Because they did it because it's a horror story, but
I tell you, and that's a good way to look at it. And not only that, but I also like to have people who don't even write or not even work as an editor or anything, but they're avid readers, because avid readers will give you an aspect that, you know, someone who's been in writing, because they don't know the terminology and all that, they just know what they like and what they don't like. They can mark where, you know, they stopped reading or it slowed down or, you know. So, yeah, you're right. You know, having someone that's out of the genre, that's a very good idea.
Now, as an editor, Michael, I have my Susan, she's unable to get on mic at the moment, but we were wondering, is there anything, you know, just kind of piggybacking on the newbie writer topic we were discussing earlier, are there any sorts of things as an editor that just make you want to put your story down and walk away? Like any certain pitfalls that you feel like people need to avoid when submitting short stories or novels, or especially when they're just starting out? Like is there certain things that they just really need to watch?
You know, I hear that and from so many times, and one of the things that I can tell you is this, there's a difference between good writing and there's a difference between that and talent. And talented writing, you can have a good writer that can write perfectly and everything would be perfect. But if the story is not there, and if it's something that you could actually see on television, or you know you've seen 100 times or 1,000,000 times, I think one of the things I call a pitfall that is for so many writers are not trying to do something different. They're trying to do what everybody else is doing. And then they can't figure out why they can't make it, why they're not being successful. You know, they're not zigging when everybody else is zagging. And one of the things that I can bring up about that is in anthologies, if I was to do a horror trope anthology, and I said I'm going to do an anthology with where all of the old horror tropes are going to be involved. So there would be vampire and, you know, Frankenstein and the mummy and all these different stories. 9 times out of 10, probably, well, not 9 times out of 10, but probably if I had, let's say, 5,000 submissions, 4,900 of them will probably be vampire stories. Nobody thinks out of the box. And nobody realizes that out of that 4,900 stories, only one vampire story is going to be selected. And so they're competing with others, whereas somebody who's writing Creature from the Black Lagoon kind of story, and two or three people have written, you know, that type of story, they're going to have a better chance at getting in the anthology. And for some reason, it seems like writers don't think in those terms that, you know, I really want to be in this anthology. And they always, I guess what I'm saying is they write the first thing that they can think of, and they start with something. And the problem with that is that same thing everyone else was thinking of as well. So you have 4,000 stories that are almost identical. And I think writers, in other words, should have their own voice and start writing for themselves. Stop trying to write like Stephen King. Stop trying to write like Michael West, you know, and be themselves, you know. And when I put together Writer's Workshop of Horror, Joe Lansdale put a piece in there, and it was really great, and he said that he tried to write like a couple of big names, you know, and he did, you know, a couple of stories that he did was, you know, sounded, read a whole lot like Ray Bradbury and different people.
Yeah.
And until he found his own voice, and it was a true blue Joe Lansdale story, that's when he started, you know, finding publication. And I defy you. You can read a story by Joe Lansdale without seeing his name, and you know it's a Joe Lansdale story, and no one else writes like him. And I'm not saying try to write like Joe Lansdale. I'm saying try to write like, you know, yourself. Be yourself. Come up with something new and different. Bring something new to the table.
I really believe that is. I believe that's fantastic advice,
yeah.
Because the thing is with what you were mentioning about vampire stories. I'm at a point now where if I read another vampire story, there better be something in there that I haven't already seen or read 100 times
yeah.
before. It needs to be
absolutely.
Something new.
Yeah,
and
that, you have to. You have to do something different with it. You can't take something and just rehash it. You have to bring mm-hmm. something new to the table. You know, if it's a zombie, then, you know, you want to do something different. You know, maybe it's a zombie grasshopper or something like that, you know. But you want to bring something different. You don't want to do the same thing that everybody else is doing. And the reason is because, well, they can just buy everybody else's stuff.
Right.
Exactly.
No, that's one fear that I had when I was doing the vampire anthology was I'm like, okay, well, here I'm going to get, you know, 18, 19 stories about vampires, and they're all going to, you know, be too close to each other, you know. But I lucked out in that, you know, no two stories were even similar to each other.
Yeah, and you know, I was talking about Specters and Coal Dust, the anthology that I did, and I always give this example is everybody was writing a story about someone who's a coal miner goes underground, and there's a ghost coal miner that saves him, you know, from and so that was something that I saw quite a bit of. Well, Bev Vincent, who is a tremendous writer, great guy, knows what he's doing. He wrote a story about Centralia, which is a town in Pennsylvania that literally is on fire and has been on fire since, I guess, the 70s, 60s or 70s. They've had to move, evacuate the entire town. And his story was set around that. And so it was completely different. And he's a fantastic writer, so you know, it was an easy way to say, oh yeah, you're in.
Now, when it comes down to reading, I have read quite a few mainstream books and independent books, and one thing that I'm noticing is that we went through this kind of stale stage where everyone seemed to just jump on the bandwagon with a similar theme or topic, or, as you were mentioning, a writing style. And one thing that has really been refreshing to me over this, I'd say about maybe the last year to 2 years, and this is in the mainstream and also in the independent world as well, I've noticed quite a bit more of a diversity. I think that, especially in the independent world, I think that a lot of are more so along the lines now considering, well, if I want to stand out and if they're serious about their work, let me stress, if they're serious about their work, if they're not serious, they're going to produce the same thing that's been done over and over and over. But I have noticed for the authors who are serious that they are starting to think outside of the box quite a bit more. And as I read something, I look at it and say, wow, that is a different thought. And when you present a book such as The Return of Mothman, like how you're doing, that just adds a lot more to it because you're giving us a different angle. And with you not being able to explain in depth about what you present in this book, it gets me excited because that tells me this is something new about Mothman that I have not seen or read before.
Yeah, and I think you're right. And one of the things, too, with you know, the differences that you see in with writers today as what you saw a long time ago, it's much easier for someone to get published. It's a lot easier for someone to, you know, if worse comes to worse, if nobody will publish them, they can do it themselves.
Yeah.
And that's not always a good thing. It's not, you know, it's not always a bad thing either. You know, and I'm not going to try to badmouth self-publishing. But the thing that I will say this is don't worry so much about getting published, but make sure that when you do that you're published well, that you're, that what you do put out there is good, that it's quality, because if not, it's going to haunt you. I have stories that are under another name that are out there that I had published in freebie markets and stuff like that, that I wish to Cthulhu I could go out and get them back without anyone seeing them. But it's not going to happen. They're out there for the world to see. And thank God I was smart enough to use a different name. So
I hate to break up the party, but we're at about a minute. So if you guys want to wrap up, and Michael, if you want to give any links so that our listeners can find you.
Sure, you can always find me on Facebook. I'm pretty much an idiot on Facebook. I love having fun and putting jokes on and carrying on. And I have a 5-year-old named Bella who is the light of my life. And so I post photos of her and me, and we do videos and stuff like that. And she's cooler than I'll ever be in my life. And you can also find me on michaelnost.com. That's my website. And you can find the link on that to the pre-order of Return of the Mothman and also the link for Dark Trails on the Kickstarter.
Awesome.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Michael. Really appreciate you having you here at the Star Chamber.
Well, thank you. I'm honored that you guys would think that I was worthy enough to be on with you guys, and really enjoyed talking with you. And I just wish that someone would have asked me the getting laid question, and nobody did.
Well, it just means we're going to have you back. that's
okay.
All it means.
That's fair.
Well, thank you very much, and yeah, have a great night, Michael, and be sure to join us next week when we have Bitten by Books' own Rachel Smith and Violet Patterson. But signing off from the Star Chamber Show, this is Stephen, and anybody else want to say their good nights?
Good night, everyone. Don't fall down any stairs tonight.
Watch out for death.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Night.
Right.